This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
This is the Woman's Hour podcast. Today on the programme, we're going to talk about a book that is fantastically unsmug about marriage. Anna Whitehouse and Matt Farquharson have put together a book called Where's My Happy Ending? And it's particularly useful if you're in the early, tough, young child-rearing years of marriage. So they're my guests on the programme today. And we begin a three-part series celebrating friendship. Today we'll meet two young women who forged a very, very close link. They are both basically young women with experience of foster care, and it's made their friendship really important. So they are on the programme today as well. First of all, we are going to discuss HRT again. There'll be some sighs of, oh, why are you doing that again? Well, but we are doing it because it's back in the newspapers again. A lot of talk about HRT. We know there is a shortage of some sorts of hormone replacement therapy, and women are travelling across the country in some cases. They are ordering it online. The Royal College of Obstetricians and Gynaecologists have said they are concerned about women buying HRT from unregulated online sites. Some sites were found to be selling products at four times the NHS price. So let's bring in Dr. Sarah Jarvis, Clinical Director of PatientAccess.com, and frankly, a woman who spends more time at Broadcasting House than I do. But
I do spend quite a lot of time seeing patients too.
Of course you do, yeah, well, I know. So first of all, your view on why there is a shortage, what do you say about that?
Well, the trouble is we don't actually know. We do know in the last 20 years, the last 17 years since the first publication of this big study, an American study which has subsequently been discredited, which said that women who took HRT were at high risk of heart attack and stroke. We know that's not true for women during their menopausal years. Since that time, there's been a huge drop in the number of women taking it, and therefore for companies, it's been difficult to assess whether it's worth their while producing it and whether, you know, how many stocks to get in. Now, all we hear is there are manufacturing supplies. One of the companies where there were big problems has been taken over by another, and they have ramped up production. So there is some good news. And actually, a lot of the places now, we are at least getting to grips with which forms of HRT are a problem, when they might be back in stock, and your pharmacist is going to be able to advise on alternatives.
So have a word with your pharmacist. We have a statement from the Department of Health and Social Care. They say the addition of HRT to the drug tariff is completely unrelated to the shortage. That was certainly a belief that actually that was exactly the explanation for the shortage. But the Department of Health say, no, that isn't the reason. Brexit was also mentioned.
Yeah,
that apparently not the reason
either. No.
OK. Well, people can certainly have their view, and you're very welcome to contact us at BBC Women's Hour on Twitter and Instagram, or email via the website. So, first of all, the dodgy sites, potentially. Yeah. Should you ever buy drugs online?
Yes, you can buy drugs online, but you do need to be really, really careful. For instance, online doctors, you need to look on the site and check that the doctors are registered with the General Medical Council, the GMC, that they have that registration up front, that the site is appropriately regulated. There are some pharmacists, for instance, where you can get products which used to be available only on prescription, now from pharmacists under something called a PGD. Now, I'm not aware of any pharmacists offering HRT, but I think that's probably going to be coming.
How do you know you're getting the real thing, though?
Well, the point is that if you've gone to a reputable site. If you've gone to an online pharmacy, it will have a green cross, and when you click on that link, it will take you to the Royal Pharmaceutical Society and it will tell you the registration, and that means that they are fully regulated. If you go onto any of these places where it looks too good to be true, then it probably is, whereas online doctors can provide it. But interestingly, online doctors may well be having the same problems getting hold of HRT as NHS doctors.
Why not just change, if the HRT you were on isn't available, why not just change to another product?
Well, I've heard over the years so many stories from women who've had different side effects. And one of the problems we've got is that different HRTs, like different forms of contraception, have different side effects. And unfortunately, you cannot tell, looking at a woman, I cannot look at one of my patients and say, you would be best suited for that, because I don't know. One woman might find this HRT fantastic and the next one dreadful, cause nausea, cause hot flushes, cause weight gain, etc., etc., breast tenderness. Another woman might find the second HRT absolutely acceptable. So the best way to do it is to speak to your pharmacist. The BMS website, the British Menopause Society website, has a really great resource where you can go online and look and see if your HRT is available, and your pharmacist can go and look online and see what the closest alternative is that
right.
is available.
Are people okay? I happen to have a lovely pharmacist, I should say. Are people okay to stand up in a chemist and chat to the pharmacist about their HRT?
Very good question. These days, of course, more and more pharmacies, in fact, I would say the majority of pharmacies, have a private consultation room. So go into your pharmacy, speak to the pharmacist's counter assistant, explain you've got a problem, say you'd like to speak to the pharmacist. They will usually be very happy to take you into a separate room and speak to you in confidence. And don't forget, pharmacists know as much as any GP about medicines. They've done a degree and extra training in it.
Yeah, they are not, I'm no way being rude about shop assistants, but they are not shop assistants. These people are
very highly qualified.
Yeah. Here's an email actually echoing something you said. On my new HRT drug, says this listener, I just couldn't work. I had joint pain. I cried constantly. I didn't have any energy. My mood swings were diabolical. I am freelance. I financially support my family and I have to work. And my HRT original drug did allow me to do this.
And I think that's a really important comment, because, of course, we do forget so many people out there go, oh, it's natural to go through the menopause. Well, actually, until 100 years ago, most women didn't live long enough to go through the menopause. I strongly suspect that if men went through the same symptoms as some women do, they would be up in arms about it. But I think it does put into perspective the risks. We do know that there is an increased risk of breast cancer, and a study that came out in August last year suggested the risk might be bigger than we thought. So people taking continuous combined, which is where you take both estrogen and progesterone all month and don't get periods, one in 50 extra women, they estimate, taking HRT for 5 years will get breast cancer. For women taking sequential combined, where you have a bleed every month but you're taking estrogen and progesterone, one in 70. And there does even appear to be a smaller increased risk, one in 200 women, for women who've had a hysterectomy and therefore take estrogen only HRT.
But if there's no breast cancer in your family, as far as you're aware, if you are a light drinker, a non-smoker, mm-hmm. you're not overweight, and you exercise regularly, yeah. HRT has proved to be a lifesaver.
Absolutely, and I think that's why it's up to individual women to weigh up the risks. I was relatively lucky when I went through the menopause. Had I not been adopted, which means I don't know what my family history is, then had I had really bad symptoms, I would, having looked at the evidence in great detail, have been very happy to consider HRT.
Yes.
However, that's an individual woman's decision, because the fact is, if you've got a 1 in 200 increased risk of getting it, if you get it, you don't get it 0.5%, you get it 100%.
Yeah, there is something to weigh up here. There's no doubt about that. I should say I've been on it. I'm not on it now. I'm partly not on it because it wasn't available.
Yeah.
So I didn't quite go cold turkey. I kind of weaned myself off my supply. Is that a good thing to do?
That's a really difficult question. The problem is, if you've been on HRT and you are still in the middle of the menopausal period, when you come off, you may well go through all the flushes again. And we know that the menopause now, the symptoms last for much longer. When I was a girl, when I was a medical student, I was taught, a couple of years, women will be absolutely fine. They'll get through it. Just pat them on the head for a couple of years and they'll be fine. These days, we know the symptoms can last for 7 years on average, and it could be much longer. So what NICE says is, if you come off cold turkey, things may be worse. But for other women, of course, we do know that you may simply be prolonging the agony by dropping it down, because you start to get those hot flushes as you drop it down.
Prolonging the agony. thank you for that.
And for our medical term, you know.
Cheers. For our many listeners who are saying, yes, as you said earlier, if this happened to men, there wouldn't be these shortages. Have they got a point?
I think there might be more of an outcry, I suspect. I'm quite sure that the manufacturers and the suppliers are not saying, oh, let's cut this one off because it's only women. But I have to say, I do think there might have been a bit more of an outcry.
OK, thank you very much. And we're continuing to receive your emails on this subject. If you have anything to add, and I suspect there will be a few women out there with plenty to add, you know what you can do. Thank you very much, Sarah.
Thank you.
That is Dr. Sarah Jarvis at BBC Women's Hour on Instagram and Twitter. And of course, there's always email as well. Now, Anna Whitehouse and Matt Farquharson are here. They are the duo behind a podcast called Dirty Mother Pucker, and their book, Where's My Happy Ending, is all about the trials and tribulations and indeed rewards of marriage and family life when you're in the thick of it with really young children. So Anna, Matt, welcome to the programme. Good to see you both.
Hi. Thank you.
I was slightly dreading reading this because I thought it was going to be all about how wonderful it is to be married and it's great, and I'm a slightly cynical, more than slightly cynical divorcee who wasn't expecting to get a lot out of it. But actually, you're both really honest. Was it difficult to write, Anna? Because you do separate chapters, don't you?
Yes, we wrote the book separately. We did the first 9 chapters separately, and then we read each other's chapters before writing chapter 10, which was sort of dangerously called stick or twist.
yeah.
We're still here, just about, sellotaping over the cracks.
How long have you been together?
Oh, 12 years?
Yeah, about that.
About that? You know, you lose count.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. So that was revelatory, I think, reading about Matt's experience on a free love commune, when I hadn't really thought about the implications of what it would be to read about your partner being in a Portuguese love commune. But
read
about
Matt,
it.
Any good?
Well, I mean, I was tucked away in a safe space of my own while everyone else was swapping caravans and so on. But I think the whole process of getting that rare opportunity to see inside your partner's mind was the most remarkable thing, because we talked about all sorts of things through the book, from social media and sex and porn and the impact of kids and all of those things. But also, I think probably the most revelatory bit for each of us was really getting to understand what the other one was thinking and feeling about things, which we weren't that likely to share otherwise.
Staring into that chasm of misery is
what you both acknowledge is that children, far from being something that can keep a relationship together, are actually really likely to challenge it. And I think there's a quote from you, Anna: I don't think we've heard each other properly since our second daughter was born in 2017. Just expand on that.
I think there was a point, you know, where you get married, for example, and you might not, but we did. And, you know, you say I do, and then there's this big space between I do and the end, till death do us part. And it's the same with your wedding day is supposed to be the best day of your life. And it's like, well, what is it then after that? Is it just a steady decline to the end? And I think people often have a misconception that, oh, I'll have a child and that might freshen things up at some point. No, no, no. It weighs it down significantly. And I think we all knew that. But you did a lot of research on this.
Yeah. So throughout the book, we try to get interesting anecdotal stories from individuals who had remarkable stories to tell. But we also looked into quite a lot of the academic paperwork on all of these subjects. And in most of the things that we looked at, there was a little bit of room for debate. The one area where there really wasn't was about the impact of children on relationships. And the impact is universally acknowledged to be terrible. This was found in papers that were done in Asia, in Europe, in the US, among different ethnic groups, gay couples and straight couples. That impact of a tiny person who you both adore that steals your time and your money and the moments that you have together has a universally acknowledged bad impact on your relationship.
But there was a sanctuary in acknowledging that.
Yes.
I think just fully acknowledging it, knowing it's not us, it's them.
It's everyone.
Because you feel incredibly guilty about that. And one of the best bits of advice that we got was from a therapist that we spoke to, who said the biggest mistake he finds that when people come to him is they worship their children. He said, I quite often have people getting in touch with me telling me that their marriage is in the toilet, their relationship's falling apart. And then I look at their Facebook profile and it's a picture of their kids, or it's a picture of one parent and the kids. And actually what you're doing then is you're worshipping the children at the exclusion of the person that you're raising them with. And that's a common mistake.
That's an interesting one. I hadn't really thought of it that way.
Change your profile pic.
Has that situation become much more of a thing in the last 10 years since children horrifically became Instagrammable?
I think there's a bit more honesty now. I think this is the sort of thing that it was considered shameful to talk about. You are supposed to relentlessly adore your children, feel incredibly blessed. And we do quite a lot of the time. Mm. But I don't think it's unreasonable to acknowledge that actually they do take a big toll on the relationship that you have with the person you're raising.
Well, Matt did a brilliant graph of, with children, it can go from spontaneous shin cuddle in Tesco, really high, to screaming on the pavement 2 seconds later. Yeah. Your highs are high, your lows are low. And I think it was acknowledging that that helped us actually get through it.
We'll get on to sex in a minute, everybody. Great. Would be glad to know. But let's talk money as well, because you're honest about that. And I think you use a great expression, Anna. Women like benevolent sexists.
Well, that was a piece of research that I discovered.
Oh, sorry, it was you, Matt.
A slightly controversial one.
I earn more than you, but you had that one.
But this is, so we talk about this quite a bit, right?
Hang on. Anna, you earn more than Matt.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay, just so people know that. Yeah, go on.
So we talk about this quite a bit in the book. For the first 10 years or so of our relationship, I earned more.
Yeah.
And then in the last few years, there's been a shift where Anna's earned more. And then all of a sudden, I have to make this adjustment of, well, actually, given that we've got two kids to care for, my meeting for this particular thing is less important to the family. So I've got to be the one that cancels it to go and collect a sticky infant. And there's a bit of a sort of, I think we're both comfortable saying, there's a bit of a mentality shift there that was an adjustment.
Well,
and it's an increasingly common adjustment in that something like in a third of straight relationships in the UK at the moment, the woman now earns more than the man. But people are quite nervous about talking about it. There's some research in the States that suggests that when that's the case, women lie about how much they earn, downgrading
to
a little
protect
bit.
What exactly?
To protect the fragile male ego, I guess.
Emasculation.
And men,
that's
and men
used a lot
lie
often.
About how much they earn, saying they earn a bit more. Which was interesting and surprising.
And seeing my sister and her wife, there's no weight of issue around who brings home the bacon, who cooks the bacon. There's just bacon and they deal with it.
Which isn't to say that gay relationships are without any issues at all. And I wonder whether you think that in gay relationships, particularly if children are involved, as increasingly they are now, perhaps they also fall into a kind of division of labour state of affairs?
Well, we talked about this, and actually the difference was that there, within, Matt and I have trodden a well-worn path of marriage, mortgage, babies, man and woman get married, and, you know, with hopes of a white picket fence at some point. But in same-sex couples, like with my sister, there's not male or female roles, it's just who's better at what. That's what it comes down to. So there's not a expectation that women will do this, man will do that. It's just there's no gender construct weighing them down. So they just get on with it in a way that I think a lot of relationships maybe don't in the way that we've come forward.
Move seamlessly onto porn now. I know you'd like to avoid the subject, Matt, but we're not going to. One of the reasons I do really admire this book is that you're honest about porn and the reality of the presence of porn in contemporary relationships. So a little bit about that, Anna, and about the fact that I think you tried to watch it together.
It was catastrophic. I think it was all like, we have so few hobbies together. I thought, well, why don't we make this our hobby? And then I attempted it, but it felt a little bit like I was sort of a lower tier footballer trying to play for England, because obviously Matt's been watching more of it.
Yeah, and also I think you just felt you were intruding.
It was not my space, maybe. And I think Matt will hate me for saying this, but I think the one point where I felt at my lowest was when I realised when I'd seen Matt's browser history that I definitely didn't look like any of the girls he was watching.
Matt?
So I mean, I think it's important to be clear. We don't go into a huge amount of detail.
No, you don't.
But I will say again,
I really admire your honesty.
But it's something that is a sort of grotty digital elephant in most relationships that gets overlooked. If I think of the sort of the WhatsApp groups that I'm in with my mates, it's not long before someone makes a joke about their favoured category on YouPorn or something. And one of the things that Anna said was that actually when she talks to her friends about it quite often, there is a bit of hurt there. And so we felt this was something that's probably quite common and worthy of a bit more investigation. And according to which piece of research you look at, 3 in 4 men in the UK are likely to have viewed porn in the last month. And viewed is obviously a bit of a euphemism because no one's judging the camera work.
Yeah, quite.
But this is obviously something that lurks in the background of most relationships, and most of the guys that I spoke to consider it something that's as normal and unstoppable as a sneeze, but actually for most of the women it's something that can be a little bit more hurtful, I think.
Well, I think you're right. It is hurtful because you feel, as Anna has already said, that you're not quite cutting the mustard.
It's not, yeah. I think it makes, you know, when you're postpartum and, you know, you can't have sex for medical reasons and you're twice the size you used to be, you're not the sort of, it's not the oxytocin-fueled 6 months when you first got together. And then your husband's looking at a perfectly honed woman going at it with someone else. You feel low. You know, there is a moment. I think we needed to acknowledge that within our relationship to get over it, not to get under to get over. That's not the tip.
I think one of the things that was most interesting was speaking to a feminist porn director who had exactly these experiences herself.
Erica
Lust.
Yeah.
She had, the reason she started to make porn was that she felt, you know, excluded and inferior. And her view on it is, actually, this isn't something that I can watch with my partner either. This is a private viewing experience because of that sort of pressure of having to try and replicate things or feeling a little bit inferior in comparison.
Anna?
Yeah, I mean, I think the thing I love most about Erica Lust is that she put out an advert for a woman to star in a porn film that she was making about a pianist. And one of the top Spanish...
Sorry, did say a pianist.
A pianist, not a pianist. There's a different thing.
Well, I don't know.
You want it, either way. But this top-level pianist applied. She'd never done a pornography film before. She could play the piano impeccably. And so you had a film of one of Spain's best piano players doing a porno, and I watched that and I enjoyed it. She said the hardest thing was telling the guy to not act like he does in other pornos, and that I found interesting. Is like, you know, the sex worker we spoke to, she said the one point that all couples get wrong is that men need the sex to have the knuffle, the cuddle,
and
women need the knuffle to have the sex, and because couples don't work that out, I get paid.
And is it different in same-sex relationships then?
I mean, I'd need to get my sister on the call for that.
Yeah, your sister should be on the show.
The difficult thing was that there's much less research out there on same-sex relationships because in most of the countries where gay marriage has been legal, it hasn't been legal for very long, and there's sort of 80, 90 years of research on straight relationships. We couldn't really find anything that gave us solid conclusions on the impact of pornography in those relationships. Coming back to something you mentioned earlier about the impact of kids, mm-hmm. actually kids were also quite a negative impact on gay relationships. And what tended to happen was the higher earner would work more and the lower earner would take on more of the childcare role. So it wasn't strictly done by gender, it was done by who earned the most. But the thing that really stood out, I think, and we spoke to lots of people, we spoke to ardent anti-porn advocates, we spoke to porn makers, the thing that really stood out was actually the weight of academic research suggests that porn is bad for relationships. The only times where it can improve relationship is when both parties are enthusiastically watching it together.
And we tried that and it was terrible, so
and there we'll have to leave it. Actually we will, and that's a real shame. Thank you for coming in. Where's My Happy Ending is the name of the book, and as I say, if you are that person perhaps dealing with small children and in a relationship and finding it occasionally tough, then this is going to provide, I think it will actually genuinely help, because you are both unsparing about your own weaknesses and about everybody's genuine trouble at this stage in relationships. So thank you both very much for coming in.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
It's good to see you again. I have met you before, haven't I, Anna?
Yeah, we've been on before, yeah.
The menopause isn't all that bad then. thank you very much. So it's Woman's Hour, and this is, it's worth alerting you to the fact that tomorrow, Jane Austen's Emma is in cinemas, I don't think for the first time. There's a new version out. I keep seeing the trail every time I go to see anything. And the star and the director are both on Woman's Hour tomorrow talking to Jenny. Yesterday's programme about loneliness, it really did get under the skin. I really found it in some ways very moving and slightly challenging myself at times. So if you didn't hear that, BBC Sounds is where to go for yesterday's programme about loneliness in 21st century Britain. The emails on that programme are still coming in. So I think we honestly are going to have to keep returning to the subject of loneliness because it is really a challenge for so many people. Now, a new report by the organisation Women for Refugee Women claims that women who've fled rape and other sexual violence are vulnerable to more abuse in the UK because of government policy, which they say can leave them destitute. The report contains the stories of over 100 asylum-seeking women. Now, yesterday, I met a woman we're going to call Anna. She is gay and she's from Cameroon, where homosexuality is still illegal. She came to this country in 2012 on a tourist visa, but didn't know she could claim asylum until she was taken to Yarlswood Immigration Detention Centre in 2015. There, she did submit a claim, which was refused. She's now made another claim, but isn't getting any asylum support, and she says she is, quite honestly, destitute. She told me first why she had to get out of Cameroon.
I was caught in Cameroon with another lady and I was tortured. I still have the scars all over my body. And I was locked up for a couple of days. And in the detention, I was raped by the police officer and there's really nothing I could do. Because, you know, as a lesbian woman, you don't have much rights in Cameroon. And when horrible things like that happen to you, there's no one you can turn to. So I had to run away.
Everybody listening to that story will have immense sympathy for you, Anna. And I know this is extraordinarily difficult for you to talk about.
Yeah.
So that's some years ago now.
Yes.
What was life like for you in Britain when you first got here?
So when I first got to England, I thought everything was going to be different. And even though it's much better compared to the situation back in Africa, it's still really troubling and it's still really difficult because the Home Office is not willing to help asylum seekers, support them with accommodation and otherwise support. And so I was unable to get accommodation, so I had to sleep on the bus. I had to sleep from one friend's house to the other. I had to even have sex and relationship with a man that I didn't want to because it was the only means for me to support him while he supported me with food and accommodation and all of that. So I became so ashamed of myself and I would give him sex anytime he wanted it because I didn't want him throwing me out on the streets. Right now, as I speak to you, as an asylum seeker, you're not allowed to work. You're not allowed to own a house, not own, even rent a house. You're not allowed to open as simple as a bank account. So you're basically walking on the street, not being able to do anything, even though you still have an ongoing case with the Home Office. So many refusers before you can eventually get accepted to get an accommodation for you. So it's really difficult.
How much money do you have to live on?
Usually I don't have anything because we don't get the right to work in the country. So you hang out with friends who give you maybe a mattress to sleep on the floor or they give you a couch to sleep on. And you can take their kids to school for them to give you a little, maybe £10 a week and food. Or you have to clean up their houses or you cook for them. So you do little bits and bits in the house.
Is that how you're living now?
Yes.
With a friend who gives you the odd...
Yes.
...in return for household tasks.
Yes. Yeah.
But that can't go on forever, can it?
No, it can't.
And your wish would be to be able to earn your own living?
Yes. So I can live where I want to live and I can make my own rules and decisions.
And how long ago did you last see somebody in an official role who could help you?
Actually, I have an ongoing case. So I went to court a couple of weeks ago and I'm just waiting for a decision.
So that would be your leave to remain?
Yes.
Again, for people who wouldn't have a clue what that meant... What difference would that immediately make to your life?
A huge difference, a massive difference. That will mean you'll be able to get a job, you'll be able to get a GP, you'll be able to open an account, you'll be able to get accommodation, and you'll be able to travel, go around the world, see different places.
If you were to really be honest about your life at the moment, how would you describe it?
A mess and a complete waste of life, to be honest.
Because you're someone who'd like to contribute.
I would. And that's why I'm here, to speak out.
How many other women do you know in a similar situation to you?
In the group that I am in with Women for Refugee Women, we're about 25. And that's just a tiny portion because there are lots of women out there that do not even know that there are organisations out there that can really help.
And can you give me an idea of the sort of experiences that those other women have been through?
Same kind of experience I've been through. They sleep in their friends' homes, they sleep on the buses. Some of them prostitute. They have sex with different men for money so they can, you know, take care of themselves.
The idea of spending the night on a bus, what's that like?
So you get on the bus and the bus...
What time do you get on the bus?
Okay. Once it gets to late night, you just get on the bus and the bus keeps going round and round and round and round. You're just trying to survive. You don't even know where to get off and you're just there till like early morning. You get off again, move around the city, go to the mall, or you go to the library, or you go to a shop and have a coffee if you've got spare change on you.
I'm focusing on the bus only because I want people to understand just how you've got to be at a low point to spend a night on a bus.
Yeah.
Do the drivers not pay any attention? Do other passengers take any notice of you?
Not really, because the different passengers that get on and get off the bus. And the drivers,
change too.
Some of them sometimes don't really care. Some will ask you why you're on the bus and you can explain, or they'll ask you to get off, you get off, and then you wait for the next bus and then you get on the bus again and still do the same round until the next driver asks you to get off.
Would you sleep on the bus?
Yeah, you sleep on the bus. So the whole night you can go all the way to the end and then back, and then all the way to the end and then back until the driver asks you to either leave or ask you what the problem is. Then you can jump off and get on the next bus and do the same the whole night.
She was a very, very brave contributor, actually. That was a woman we are calling Anna from the Cameroon, who I met yesterday. Natasha Walter is the founder of Women for Refugee Women. First of all, the idea that Anna is living on air. She is getting no money. I don't understand that. Why is she not getting any money at all?
Because she was, her first asylum claim was refused and all her support was cut off at that point. There are no official statistics about how many people are in this situation, but other organisations have estimated that they're thousands. And we spoke to over, in the UK now, and we spoke to over 100 women for this report who've experienced destitution, who've come to this country to seek asylum and who've experienced destitution at some point in the process. So some of them may have had problems accessing the initial asylum support. Some of them may have experienced destitution after getting their leave to remain, with the challenges of moving into mainstream benefits. Most of the women we spoke to experienced destitution, like Anna, after refusal of the first claim. And I just want to sort of highlight for your listeners that often women are getting very, very unfair refusals. You know, the Home Office often gives very, very poor decisions on women's cases. Women face a lot of disbelief. And it's very, very hard, and I think getting harder, in my experience, for women to get the kind of legal representation they need to support them to make their cases.
There's a lot to unpick there.
Do you think women
are getting a harder time than male claimants or applicants?
Yeah, I think it's really, really hard for women. We can see when women move through the criminal justice process, when they're talking about gender-based violence like rape, you know, women are often up against disbelief. It's often very hard to prove. I mean, of the women that we talked to for this report, nearly 80% said they'd experienced some kind of gender-based violence, so rape, female genital mutilation, forced prostitution, and so on. Over a third said that they'd been raped by state authorities. A similar number said that they'd been imprisoned by the state. And I think if you're looking at, you know, these are serious human rights abuses that women are fleeing from. And what's happening is, because they're not getting a fair hearing in the asylum process, they're then being made destitute and vulnerable to further violence and abuse,
as
we heard from
Anna's
Anna.
Yeah.
So, and she's not alone.
But
you know,
why might, I'm trying to understand why the British authorities might not be able to grant sanctuary to a gay woman from the Cameroon who poses no threat to anyone, who says herself she would like to contribute to British society and work, and who has been the victim of appalling violence.
Absolutely. Why can't they?
And why does the Home Office
putting women through such hardship and such pain? You know, we are working with and supporting women who maybe are living years destitute and then go through and get their refugee status, their leave to remain, and yet they've spent these wasted years on the street streets, you know, on Britain's streets, when they could be, as you say, beginning to rebuild their lives, beginning to contribute to society.
So who does get asylum? Who gets leave to remain, in your experience?
It can be quite random, but some people obviously do get leave to remain when they have well-documented cases. And I think often it does rely on having a good lawyer at the outset. And, you know, the legal aid system has been decimated. But I think, you know, it's also worth highlighting, although women face a lot of exploitation and abuse in the community, a lot of people in communities are really stepping up and helping these women. We produced this report alongside other groups in Manchester, Birmingham, Coventry and Swansea. And we're really struck by how women are coming together and actually speaking up about what's happening to asylum-seeking women. And that does make me hopeful that, you know, there is still the possibility of change, difficult though that may sometimes seem.
Anna's story is, these stories are always complicated, and I suppose you could argue that there are grey areas here. She first came to the country on a tourist visa. She didn't understand asylum. Why would she? How could she?
Yeah, but that shouldn't jeopardise her asylum case.
I'm just explaining.
We often see that women may make their way here on a student or tourist visa because you can't claim asylum from your country of origin.
No.
So there are different ways that women might make their way here. And then, you know, the problem is then gathering the evidence for the asylum claim, when, as Anna made clear, she doesn't really understand at the outset the asylum process. And that's why it's so important to have good legal representation. And that cycle of abuse that Anna was talking about. I mean, she spoke about being in a group at Women for Refugee Women. She's in the group that we support specifically for LGBT women. She talked about around 20 women. We see over 100 women every week who are going through these kind of experiences. And around a third of them that we spoke to for this report had experienced rape and sexual abuse in this country as well as in their country of origin. So we really see that their trauma is being compounded by these experiences of destitution.
So one of the answers might be, you would assume, a slicker process, more staff. Is that what we're looking
at? I think there needs to be more resourcing in the asylum process itself. And there needs to be a change of policy. We can't have support just cut off immediately that first refusal happens and women just thrown out, because then it makes it all the harder for women to gather their evidence to rebuild their lives. You know, 90% of the women our report said they were hungry, that they were depressed. You know, how are you going to start to rebuild, to find support, you know, to go forward and tell your story when you're facing that kind of trauma?
Natasha Walter, thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
I think we can all agree, we don't want to live in a country where people are sleeping on the night bus and living
on
a friend's mattress.
Absolutely, a fairer world is possible.
Well, we would hope so. Mm. Thank you very much. Now, friendship. We're going to start a three-part series on the importance of friendship and different sorts of friendship at different parts of your life. And my first two guests are, you're both 19, aren't you?
So, yes.
Well, great, really nice to have you here. Kinnira and Rachel, both with experience of foster care. Rachel is from Manchester. She's been on the programme before, so it's good to see you again. You're well into your second year, aren't you, at uni?
Yes, I am, yeah.
And what are you studying?
Psychology.
All right, okay. And Kinnira, you have got a proper job. You're working in a nursery in London.
I am.
How is that? Is that tough? It's children's nursery, I should say.
Yeah, sometimes, but it can be fun most of the time as well.
Yeah, but it's hard going, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, as long as you have your experience, then it's much easier than if you were unexperienced going into the industry.
Okay,
definitely.
Well, you do 10-hour shifts, don't you? So I imagine that they're quite challenging.
Quite long.
Towards the end of the day, I bet they are challenging. So how did you get to know each other, you two? Kinnira first.
We did meet over social media.
Yeah.
Because I moved back from Southampton a while ago now. So I was just on certain apps, just trying to like, kind of look for friends. I know sometimes it sounds dangerous, but I mean, I did it and I ran into her. So we were talking for a while, but it was kind of like awkward.
Why was it awkward?
I don't know, she's just awkward.
Rachel is?
Yeah.
That's nice. What do you say about that, Rachel?
I wouldn't say I was awkward. I'd just say, like, it was just something new for me because I just moved to London and I was kind of just looking for friends in London because all my friends were based in Manchester.
Yeah.
So it's kind of just hard to figure out what sort of person I'm, like, friends
exactly.
with and what sort of people are like.
And I think it was harder as well because I don't really go on the apps all the time. So that's when I did give her my other social media and platforms so we can talk often.
Yeah.
So then obviously once I went on, she was onto like Snapchat and all of that, we were talking like a lot more. And then that's how our friendship kind of just started.
How important is it that you have that shared experience of foster care? What would you say, Kinnira?
I don't really think about it too much just because being in care to me is just normal, to be honest. But because I don't have any other friends that are in care, it was surprising. And as well, sometimes it's helpful because, like, if you talk about something, I don't have to explain it because she knows, she understands, she's been through it. So we can just kind of have a conversation about it and then it'll be over. As if I'm talking about it to somebody else that doesn't experience that, I'll have to explain what I'm saying for them to understand first. So I guess it's kind of easier in that way.
Yeah. So I don't want to over-egg it. I suppose it'd be too easy to say, well, because of that, that means you're really bonded really quickly.
Yeah.
But as Kinnear says, Rachel, maybe it just means there is stuff, the stuff you don't need to say because you both understand.
Yeah, pretty much. Like the experiences we've been through and the way we communicate with each other about feelings and the way we feel about like keeping our friendship going is very important because we know that, you know, people have lost people and it's easier to lose people and the fact that we've been together for so long now.
Yeah. In what sense do you think, is there a time of day or maybe night more significantly when you know you could get hold of Kinnear if you needed to? Is she that person you could call at 3:30 in the morning?
Yes, 100%. And I have done it multiple times.
Have you, multiple times?
Multiple times.
And is that okay with you, Kinnear?
Oh, yeah. I'm just at home, like a wide awake.
You're wide awake? I mean, it's none of my business, but why are you wide awake at 3:30 in the morning?
I just don't sleep, really. Teenagers.
But that, I mean, that is really important. And I would say that was the measure of a proper friendship because you know she's going to be there. And when you're at uni, and I imagine, Rachel, you're probably surrounded by quite a lot of privileged young people who maybe are not the easiest for you to communicate with all the time.
Yeah, I definitely agree. Like with university, I have like such bad anxiety. Like I really struggled going into university and like making friends in general. But ever since like making friends with Kinnear and communicating with her, like I'd talk to her before I go into uni and just say like, I'm really nervous. And she'd be like, no, don't worry about it. Just go in, see how it goes and it'll be fine. Like she really supports me with getting into uni and just making other friends.
Really? Okay. Yeah. Are you proud of that, Kinnear? Because you should be.
Yes, but I'm one of them friends that kind of give the advice, but I don't take it myself.
That sounds like me.
I just dish it out to everyone.
I dish it out on the radio. I don't take it myself. You can work that way, trust me. Yeah. So do you think you'll always be a part of each other's lives? Because you're only 19. It is really young, Rachel.
Yeah. I think simply yes, simply because we didn't meet in normal circumstances. And the fact that despite we don't see each other all the time and it's not like we're uni friends or we live together, we're still friends through all of that. So I think we could easily be like long-term friends.
Yeah, 100%. I agree.
And what about, because for people of my generation, eye contact and actually meeting is really important. Mm-hmm. So you two don't just talk to each other. You actually see each other, Rachel?
Yeah, I'd say we see each other. Not too much, but we do see each other a lot. Like we FaceTime a lot. We Snapchat a lot. We Instagram a lot.
It's definitely more, the relationship is definitely sometimes more the phone at certain times in our friendship, just because obviously we have our lives to live. Because she's got uni, I've got work. So it's difficult when I only have like my weekend. Sometimes it's to spend with family and obviously other friends as well. So it's just a case of when the time comes, we meet. But we do see each other maybe like twice in a month, which is quite often.
Twice in a month.
Yeah,
wow.
Maybe.
You see, again, this
some
is just
months.
it just brings out generational differences. I have never successfully FaceTimed anybody.
Oh wow.
Oh no, I can't do it.
Why?
Because because I'd rather ring them or meet them for a coffee.
Oh no.
We sit on FaceTime for like ages and we like barely even talk and we just sit there.
Sometimes it's just having your presence. Having their presence is okay.
Okay, this is a whole new world. So you'll sit there, both on FaceTime, neither of you saying a word.
Yeah. Pretty much, just doing our things. Like, I'll be just, like, doing some homework or I'll be, like, doing something else and then she'll be cooking or doing whatever.
Because she's there the whole time, so if you want to say something, she's there.
Yeah.
You don't have to message her. So, I mean...
I'm loving this. Okay.
Probably not a weird friendship.
It's not weird. It's not weird for your generation. I want this conversation to go into a time capsule and to be played in 150 years' time, and it will be called Old Woman Interviews 2 19-year-olds about their contemporary friendship. It's been really great to see you both, and I'm glad you're doing so well, Rachel. It's brilliant. Rachel, who's in her second year at uni doing psychology, and Kinnear, best of luck to you in your career.
Thank
I know
you.
You're not necessarily certain you're going to stick with the nursery, but you might do something else.
Just to get some other work experience.
It's really good, and thank you for coming in, appreciate
thank
it
thank you very much. Thanks.
And there'll be more on friendship a little later in the week when we'll talk to two women who forged a friendship as part of a kind of digital sisterhood. A quick statement from the Home Office: the UK has a proud record of providing protection to vulnerable individuals and helping them to rebuild their lives. That's in response to our conversation with Natasha Walter of Women for Refugee Women. That was Jane Garvey, who I think is really underrated, and this is also Jane Garvey, and this is the Woman's Hour podcast. My thanks to everybody who's taken part today. I've just got some more emails actually on loneliness, which I will get to in a second because that was the subject of yesterday's programme. But on the subject of HRT, which we talked about today, having stopped HRT yet again in the hope that the hot flushes had stopped, at the age of 73, they are still with me, says one listener. Oh, God. This from Samantha. HRT shortages impacted upon women, their partners, family and work. My husband and children are really concerned that I won't be able to refill my next prescription. Louise and quite a few other people emailed to say your speaker on HRT, that's Sarah Jarvis, said that 100 years ago, few women went through menopause because they died too early. I don't think that's the right thing. Ask any demographer or historian researching that field. Well, of course, it's certainly true that 100 years ago, women did not live as long on the whole. But I imagine, of course, that some women did indeed go through the menopause. From Moira, a couple of years ago, I needed to have a joint replacement, and 1 month before, I was told by the hospital that I must come off HRT completely. I had taken it for 15 years and benefited hugely. Needless to say, I really suffered when I stopped it completely before the surgery. Apparently, there was an increased risk of blood clotting. It's difficult to describe how bad I felt. Another Samantha, I have 4 patches left. I may have to cut them in half. I hope the supplies begin to appear at the end of the month as promised, but I'm not holding my breath. Samantha is right. It was the end of this month when we are told that things should be getting better. From Rachel on the subject of marriage and the conversation I had with Matt and Anna. Rachel says, I met my husband when I already had an 18-month-old. We met and married, and get this, had 5 more children in 8 years. 17 years in now, the kids are growing up, and I still really like him very much, despite the chaos of running this house with 2 professional careers to juggle as well. However, my worry is we've never had any time for us. What happens when they've all gone? Well, it could, I mean, Rachel, don't be too negative. It could be absolutely fabulous. Paul says, thoroughly appreciate the honesty of the 2 guests, but disagree with some of their comments. In my relationship with my wife, we don't always prioritise my job because I earn more. I value what my wife does, and so I do sacrifice as well. Also, with regards to porn, if my friends made a joke about their favourite porn category, I'd ask them how their wife was doing. Well, that's good of you. I had a most peculiar PR email this morning in my inbox, drawing my attention to the most popular searches on porn sites. And it contained, I think, the fascinating nugget of information that every month, 270 British people search for porn about airport security staff. I'm as baffled as you probably are. And if you're an airport security person, I don't know whether you should be flattered or not, really. Now, I did say that we are still getting emails about loneliness because that was what we talked about on the programme yesterday. Not a perfect programme because none of them are, but I thought there were some really interesting comments made on yesterday's programme. So if you didn't catch that, obviously, you can find the podcast. This is from a listener called Pauline who says, I'm British, but I've been living in a large suburban American city for over 20 years. I'm no longer working and I feel lonely and isolated. I thought my problem was basically my location. I thought the British way of life in towns and villages would mitigate the loneliness, but listening yesterday, it seems it doesn't. It was a real help to me to hear that so many others are struggling in exactly the same way. I also want to say BBC Radio is a lifeline for me, and I'm sure for many millions of others, and I'm really concerned about funding decisions in the future. Please tell the Minister for Loneliness and any other relevant politicians how important the BBC is to so many of us around the world. Thank you for that. And what else? Has anybody else, asked the listener, felt stigmatised because they live alone and don't mind? Some people actually appreciate quietness and solitude and enjoy activities for which they don't need others, like playing a musical instrument, listening to the radio or reading. Not everybody likes dogs. No, I know, and dogs do crop up very early on in any conversation about loneliness and isolation. The assumptions that people make about people on their own can cause shame in those of us who are quite happy without constant interruptions and demands. As listeners' comments show, it's possible to be lonely in a crowd, group or family. The quality of friendship is what matters. And from a listener called Hannah, I was really touched by this conversation today. It also made me think how amazing my woman's circle has been for facilitating a sense of deep connection. I recently started a circle with a group of women from a parent and child group we go to, and then a few people invited somebody else. We don't all know each other, or didn't, and we weren't all close friends. We meet once a month and hold a sharing circle. It's a safe space where everyone gets a turn to share what's going on for them. Joy, grief, rant in anger, voice something they're processing, anything at all. Whilst everyone else listens, that's active, engaged listening without interrupting or giving advice afterwards. It feels really good to be heard without people trying to fix you. And from Debbie, a recommendation that the National Women's Register is something worth exploring if you haven't found solace in, for example, the WI, which I know is an organisation that a lot of people find very helpful, but like everything, not for everyone. The University of the Third Age always crops us up as well, a lot of people recommending that. And this from a listener who says, when I divorced in my late 30s, a single friend said to me, you have to go out into the world. It won't come to you. I think that's sadly true. With gritted teeth, says the listener, I joined a local get-together and a local political association. No local real friends before, but suddenly the community started opening up. It gets easier with practice too. On retirement, I joined a choir, and I cannot recommend highly enough the friendship and good feeling that has provided. Many new and some close friends now, and one thing can lead to another. It is never too late. Thanks, everybody, who is still emailing on that subject. Honestly, I think you're giving solace to a lot of people in similar situations. So, honestly, it's brilliant. Thank you very much for that. Jenny's here tomorrow, amongst many other things, discussing yet another film of a Jane Austen book. There's a new Emma, and the director and the star are both on the programme tomorrow. And apparently some of my colleagues have gone off without me, which isn't unusual, to see a preview of that film. And they really enjoyed it. Well, thanks very much for inviting me. So that's on the programme tomorrow.
If you're listening to some other podcast, then stop now and listen to a good one, because The Infinite Monkey Cage is back for a new series, and we're doing loads of things, aren't we, Robin?
We're going to be dealing with the science of laughter, conspiracy theories, coral reefs, quantum worlds, and finally UFOs. I love UFOs. It's also, by the way, the UFO one available to watch on iPlayer. In fact, all of the series that we've done are available on BBC Sounds.
I must say that I wouldn't bother with the first series. I don't think it's very good.
I wouldn't bother with the first two.
Yeah.
But we were played by different people then, I think, weren't we?
Yeah, yeah. Melvin Bragg was you, and...
You were Debbie McGee.
Debbie McGee. Yeah.
Bragg and McGee. Now that is a 1980s TV detective series that I will be making.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Collider says BritBox has TV everyone should be watching. Stream acclaimed series with powerful performances from Jodie Whittaker, Tamara Lawrence, Bella Ramsey, and Matthew McFadyen. Discover new BritBox original series you won't find anywhere else. Like Three Little Birds, Agatha Christie's Murder is Easy, and a new chapter of BAFTA-winning drama, Time. Stream what the New York Times calls the best of British telly, only on BritBox. Start a free trial at BritBox.com.